We want to have a strategy and a plan that moves forward, that accomplishes the goal of cleaning up the air, but also makes assurances that everyone can stay warm.
Fairbanks voters reject a ban on regulating air quality. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, big increases in Bering Sea crab numbers shake up the season.
Where have these crab been? Why have we not been seeing them? I would say it raises more questions than answers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
An investigation into fraud in the Alaska National Guard is now underway. The audit team is comprised of three investigators from the National Guard Bureau. They arrived over the weekend and will look into allegations of embezzlement and misuse of funds. Their findings are due in a draft report this December. An earlier report by the National Guard Bureau documented instances where money was siphoned from family programs and government equipment was used for personal gain. The fraud investigation is part of a six-point plan recommended by the National Guard Bureau after its investigators concluded there was a crisis of confidence in forces leadership and that reports of sexual assault were mishandled. Governor Sean Parnell also addressed other reform efforts today in a message uploaded to his official Vimeo account. In addition to describing the approach his office is currently taking, Parnell addressed criticisms that he delayed responding to allegations of malfeasance.
To have the critics say that I would know about something that's gone on in the National Guard and not done something for 4 years, that is just not true. It's not who I am, and Alaskans know it.
Since a report by federal investigators into the Alaska Force was released last month, whistleblowers have come forward to express disappointment with the response. Emails and meeting notes from chaplains in the Guard show they alerted the governor's office to problems with Guard leadership in 2010. Parnell says he or his staff followed command protocol on every allegation, and the Guard leadership told him matters were being handled appropriately. Just an hour before Parnell released his video message, the group Alaska Women for Political Action held a press conference calling for the firing of two top National Guard leaders, Brigadier General Mike Bridges and General Catherine Jorgensen, along with Parnell Chief of Staff Mike Nizek. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has issued a temporary halt to gay marriages in Alaska. The Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco issued the stay late this afternoon. It allows the state until Friday to get a stay from the U.S. Supreme Court. If that stay isn't issued, the federal court action dissolves at 11 a.m. on Friday, when gay marriages will be allowed to go forward. U.S. District Judge Timothy Burgess on Sunday struck down Alaska's ban on same-sex marriages as unconstitutional. Gay couples began applying for marriage certificates Monday, beginning a 3-day clock to when ceremonies could be held on Thursday. However, some couples received waivers from judges and have already married. Voters in the Fairbanks North Star Borough have rejected a ballot initiative that would have continued a ban on local regulation of area clean air standards. A final tally of question and absentee ballots following last week's municipal election shows the initiative has lost by 356 votes. That means the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly now has the authority to regulate home heating devices and make decisions about area clean air standards. The local group Citizens for Clean Air campaigned heavily for Proposition 2 over the last few weeks. They painted old tires with the phrase, "tired of dirty air," to encourage voters to vote no on Proposition 2. Group co-sponsor and longtime air quality activist Patrice Lee says she's pleased with the outcome.
I'm happy. I'm excited for the whole group. I mean, you can't believe all the fun we had rolling around our tires in the dark and with no light and with headlamps on and, you know, tired of dirty air. Well, we are, but we're here, and now we have a chance to try to make some progress at a local level. And that's a good thing for the community.
This is the third time borough voters have considered the proposition. It was first considered in 2010 and again in 2012, failing in both those years. Lee says already has a meeting planned for Tuesday evening to strategize on how to move forward, regardless of the outcome.
We have a whole community that we care about, and while we're passionate about our side of the issue, we're also cognizant of what people are dealing with. And so we want to have a strategy and a plan that moves forward, that accomplishes the goal of cleaning up the air, but also makes assurances that everyone can stay warm.
The proposition to keep the borough from regulating home heating appliances, including wood stoves and boilers, is sponsored by North Pole Republican State Representative Tammy Wilson. Previous failures of the initiative gave the state authority to regulate air quality in and around North Pole and downtown Fairbanks when air quality has been identified as a problem. 2014 municipal election results will be certified next week. Two candidates running for Alaska governor debated during a forum yesterday in Fairbanks. Sean Parnell defended his administration when Bill Walker questioned what the current governor is doing about the high cost of energy in the interior.
I am totally focused on reducing energy costs and fuel costs here in the interior and across the state. And when I think about one of the ways that I've worked to do that in this gas line negotiations and the agreements that have been signed, I made sure that Fairbanks residents would pay the lowest price cost for gas, whether that is Cook Inlet prices or whether that is North Slope prices.
Candidate Bill Walker says the cost of energy is his top priority.
You know, Governor Parnell has had 6 years to bring down the cost of energy in Fairbanks, and I plan to bring down the cost of energy. We need an immediate plan, a midterm, and a long-term plan. The first thing I'll do as governor, I will issue a declaration of disaster on the cost of energy in interior Alaska.
Walker says he believes a declaration will make a difference because it will bring greater attention to the cost of energy in the region. The candidates also addressed the closure of the Flint Hills refinery in North Pole. Bill Walker says the governor simply didn't do enough to keep the refinery open.
Well, the first thing I would have done, what we should have done, is the governor should have met with them after they came to see him months before the announcement of shutting down, asking for help, saying we're in trouble, can you help us? I would have gotten back to them with a solution, be part of the solution.
Governor Parnell says he made an effort to keep the refinery open, and he was surprised by the closure.
I told them, this is your moment to go speak with the Attorney General. Now, my Attorney General is Mike Garrity, a Fairbanks boy. Do you really think that he would just sit there and do nothing, or do you think he went to work with it? I'll submit that the refinery closing was a huge blow. It is nothing, it's something that caught me by surprise, but it is not something that I anticipated.
The forum was hosted by the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. Republican U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan raised more money than Democratic Senator Mark Begich during the latest fundraising quarter. Sullivan raised $2.8 million for the period, which includes $264,000 reported in a July pre-primary filing. Begich reported raising $1.9 million, which includes $423,000 from the July report. Begich and Sullivan each ended the quarter with about $1.2 million available. Sullivan reported $43,000 in debt, which the campaign said was from the primary. The race's outcome could help decide control of the U.S. Senate. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, preparing for earthquakes with the Great Alaska Shakeout Drill.
We really want people to practice the drop, cover, and hold. So when that shaking begins and there's a little bit of panic, they'll know what to do.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The United Fishermen of Alaska have inducted the late journalist Bob Takach into its Hall of Fame. Takach, who covered the legislature and specialized in writing about the commercial fishing and seafood industries, died last May at age 61. He was one of five inductees by the Trade Association. The others were retiring State Senator Fred Dyson of Eagle River, Albert Ball Sr., Jim Callender, and Keith Jeffords. The Fisherman's Group says Ball, Callender, and Jeffords died this past year. Today marked the opening of the Bering Sea crab season. Quotas are up almost across the board, but one species that usually takes a back seat is outshining the rest. And as KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, that's got some fishermen changing their game plans.
2 years ago, there was no harvest for Baradai tanner crab. Without enough legal females in the water, it wasn't safe to fish. When the season reopened last year, the quota was kept low. But now, fish and game biologist Heather Fitch says Baradai seem to have bounced back.
If you compare it to the whole history of this stock, it's at one of its peak biomasses.
And that's made for the highest quota since 1993. About 15 million pounds of Baradais are up for harvest in the Bering Sea. That's five times as much as last year. Fitch says new survey data shows legal-sized Baradais spread out all across the region. It also shows a surprising amount of red king crab, about 50% more of all sizes compared to the past couple of years. Fitch says it's almost like they came out of nowhere.
Just based on not seeing it come into the population, it does raise a lot of questions as to where have these crab been? Why have we not been seeing them? I would say it raises more questions than answers.
But the harvest level for red king crab isn't based on those numbers alone. Managers plug data from the past several years into a model, which gave them a new increased catch limit of 10 million pounds. This will be the first time in years that there's less red king crab up for harvest than Baradai. But reds are still worth more. To get the payoff, fishermen will have to rush to meet a Thanksgiving deadline in the lucrative Japanese market. And that's why the Pacific Sun was heading straight for king crab as the season opened Wednesday. Captain Jeff Hochstein says they'll lease their share of Baradais to another boat, like usual. He thinks others might want to do the same.
I don't know how many extra boats are going to do it versus what has done it in the past, but it could be a lengthy season if they don't split it up a bit.
That's the plan for the seven crabbers in the Mariner fleet. Moore Dye is the captain of the Western Mariner. Their strategy?
There's so much of the quota that we'd have three of our boats fishing on the eastern side, two boats on the western side, and then two boats are going up to do St. Matthew's Blues.
Blue king crab up north near St. Matthew Island is small potatoes compared to the rest of the Bering Sea species. The blue king fishery was closed in 2013, and now the quota's the lowest it's ever been. For the most part, the fleet wants to end their season like normal, with snow crab. That quota has increased too, though it wasn't an easy decision for managers. Heather Fitch says Fish and Game's standard snow crab model has been unreliable lately, so this year they turned to surveys and settled on a quota that's up about 25%. With so much crab up for harvest this season, Bering Sea fishermen could be working well into the springtime and hopefully reaping the financial rewards. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
A Seattle-based seafood company accused of stealing groundfish from the Bering Sea has agreed to pay up. American Seafoods will pay $1.75 million to settle violations on three of its catcher processors. The American Dynasty, the Ocean Rover, and the Northern Eagle were all accused of tampering with their scales for weighing fish at sea over a five-year period. Crew members allegedly fixed the scale so they would weigh light, allowing them to take in up to 27% more pollock and other fish than they were reporting. That's a violation of the Magnuson-Stevens Act and the American Fisheries Act. American Seafoods tried to fight back against some of the charges by bringing the case to an administrative judge. Their settlement is about $1 million less than what the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration originally wanted to charge. Besides the fine, the case also prompted a new set of rules for vessels that weigh their catch at sea. Starting in January, factory trawlers will have to use scales that can track calibration data, and they'll need to file digital weight reports every day. On top of that, the entire weigh-in area must be monitored on video. NOAA spokeswoman Julie Spiegel says that should reduce the possibility of scale tampering and make it easier for regulators to pick out fraud down the road. At a public hearing last night in Juneau, locals spoke out nearly 4-1 against transportation officials' efforts to extend the capital city's main road 48 miles farther north. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has more.
More than 50 people testified on the latest version of a federally required environmental impact statement for the Juneau Access Improvements Project. Mendenhall Valley resident Brandy Gerke summed up many of the opponents' key concerns about the road building option that transportation officials have favored for years.
Perceived convenience is being prioritized over cost and safety.
Highway construction along the east side of Lynn Canal is estimated to cost $523 million. The new road would end at the Katsaheen River, where a new ferry terminal would make short connections to Haines, Skagway, and the road system. The new terminal and ferries are estimated at another $51 million. According to the EIS, the plan would also drive up the State Transportation Department's operations and maintenance costs by about 30% compared to the status quo. On safety, the document projects about 22 crashes per year on the new road and about one traffic death every 6 years, based on statewide data from similar roads. But the safety concern folks repeatedly cited was avalanches. The proposed road crosses 41 avalanche paths.
The fear of the road would probably eliminate a lot of people's actual access out of, as well as to, Juneau.
That's Larry Spengler, who lives on the avalanche-prone Thane Road.
Do we want our children on their school buses driving up that road to a ferry terminal? I'd much rather put them on the ferry in Auk Bay.
The high risk would be driven down through engineering, explosive avalanche control, and simply closing the road when the avalanche risk is highest, forecast at about 12 days a year. Motorists would still face moderate avalanche risk, though. More than on Thane Road, but less than on the Seward Highway, according to an avalanche risk index in the EIS. Juneau Mayor Merrill Sanford, speaking for himself, ticked off what the upside would be.
To be able to transport 10 times the number of vehicles, provide 5 to 7 times the number of ferry trips per week, cut travel time in half or more, and cut traveler costs up to 75%.
And he added 3 to 5 years of construction jobs. Wayne Jensen said it's incumbent on Juneau as a capital city to support the road and improve access for other Alaskans. Enhancing Juneau as the capital city is the mission of the nonprofit Alaska Committee that he chairs. Another common thread in opponents' testimony was skepticism toward cost estimates and traffic projections in the 694-page EIS. A few people even made outright accusations that officials cooked the books. That wasn't exactly what project manager Gary Hogans said he'd be listening for.
Federal Highways and the department will respond to all comments, but the comments that are most helpful to us is constructive. Do we make a mistake? Is there a gap in our information? You know, that sort of thing.
Tim Haw is the Environmental Program Manager for the Alaska Division of the Federal Highway Administration. His agency would pay for much of the capital cost of the project and has the final say in which option is greenlit. He said the selection is based on
a balanced analysis of the transportation need with the environmental impacts, be they social, economic, or natural.
He said building the road best serves the overall public interest while improving transportation. And politics, he said they aren't a factor at this stage.
Politics didn't play into our, won't play into our decision.
The public comments will become part of the Federal Highway Administration's record and may lead to revisions in the final version of the environmental impact statement, which is expected next fall. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
This year was the 50th anniversary of the Great Alaska Earthquake, and earlier this summer, a magnitude 6.2 shook south-central Alaska. Earthquakes on the mine may be why thousands of Alaska residents have already signed up to take part in the largest earthquake drill in the world.
On October 16th at 10:16, Alaska will be doing the Great Alaska Shakeout, but there's many other states and nations throughout the world that will be doing a shakeout drill on the same day at the same time.
Jeremy Zedek works with the state's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He says to date, more than 20 million people have signed up to participate worldwide. That includes more than 76,000 Alaskans. For more information, you can go to alaskapublic.org. This week, the Calista Corporation begins touring the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta to educate shareholders about the impacts of enrolling more people. Next year, shareholders will decide whether to enroll descendants. As KYUK's Ben Matheson reports, increasing the number of owners would impact governance of the company and the size of shareholder dividends.
People born after December 18, 1971, when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act created the Alaska Native Corporations, were not enrolled as shareholders, creating a split between the original shareholders and the so-called afterborns. The Calista Corporation, the company made of shareholders from 56 YK Delta villages, is gearing up to inform voters about the consequences of enrolling those born in the 40 years since ANCSA. Tom Leonard is Calista's communication manager. He says the company's been talking with corporations which have enrolled descendants, like Sea Alaska and Doyon.
So for the past year or so, we've been having meetings with them, talking with them, emailing back and forth, trying to get as much information as possible as to what the impacts would be, what things went smoothly, what things did not, and maybe even some unanticipated consequences of enrolling descendants.
The company has about 12,900 shareholders today, of which 9,200 are original shareholders. The only way to receive shares now is by inheritance or through a gift within a family. If Calista issues shares to descendants in 2017, they estimate that the number of shareholders could triple.
So Calista Corporation is neutral on this. We're not advocating one way or the other. The decision is going to be up to the shareholders at the 2015 annual meeting.
If passed by a majority vote, Calista would create two new share classes.
Class C shareholders would be the descendants that are enrolled. And they would each get 100 shares. Class D shareholders would be the people who could have enrolled back in 1971, but did not for one reason or another.
Calista issued a record dividend last year of $3.50 per share, a total of $4.65 million. Leonard says increasing the number of shareholders changes each shareholder's stake in the company, and that would mean a reduction in dividend size.
If the number of shareholders doubles, then you know that would reduce the per share dividend by 50%. If the number of shareholders triple, then it would be one-third per share of the dividend.
Calista is planning on visiting 20 communities in the coming months to talk with shareholders about the process and upcoming vote. The tour kicks off Wednesday in Tinuunik and comes to Bethel November 12th. A website, calistavote.com, will be another source of information. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The State of Alaska Department of Natural Resources Pipeline Coordinator's Office collected comments on a natural gas pipeline being proposed by the Donlin Gold Company at Bethel's Cultural Center Monday evening. It was the first state hearing on the pipeline that would run from Cook Inlet to the proposed Donlin Creek mine site near Crooked Creek. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has the story.
The dozen or so people who showed up to the hearing had more questions than comments, and many of them sounded something like Martin Nikolai's from Queethluk.
If Donlin builds the pipeline, will it benefit the residents of Alaska, or will it benefit only the Kuskokwim people or Calista? Donlin is going to be out in operation for 30 years. After that period ends, what will happen to the pipeline? Is it going to benefit the Kuskokwim Valley and the Yukon River villages?
Many wanted to know how a natural gas pipeline could be leveraged to benefit their communities and ease the region's high energy costs. Donlin is looking to build a natural gas pipeline spanning roughly 315 miles from Beluga on Cook Inlet to the proposed mine site about 120 miles upriver from Bethel near Crooked Creek. 207 of those miles are over state land. The hearing was specifically to address the pipeline right-of-way on state land. Donlin officials say they can mine 1 million ounces of gold per year from an open-pit mine at the site, but they'll need cheap, reliable power, in this case natural gas, to run ore crushers, an oxygen plant, a mill, and general operations including a camp of 600 people, and possibly even heavy machinery that runs on natural gas. Small business owner Dan Leinberger says he's supportive of a pipeline, but he wants assurances that the state will look into a public-private partnership to bring a line to the lower Kuskokwim where more people live.
It's nice that Donlin would be able to get relatively cheap power
But as the previous speaker said, what does it do really for the rest of us out here? I would be supportive of this venture, but I also like to see the benefits reap the entire Delta, not just Donlin Gold.
Donlin, which is equally owned by NovaGold Resources and Barrick Gold Corporation, anticipates more than 100 permits will be needed for the project, and regulators are working on a 2,000-page environmental impact statement. Mark Springer, a member of the Bethel City Council, says anything that would bring lower-cost power to Bethel has a high-potential public benefit.
The idea that we could have significant power generation capacity with an attendant distribution network is very exciting. Alternatively, a pipeline downriver is a possibility, although I personally believe it would be much less expensive to operate a high-voltage DC network down this way. And as a common carrier, as basically a commercially operated pipeline, I don't think that the life expectancy of it should be tied to the potential life of and demand from the Donlin Creek mine.
State officials say Donlin would likely only require up to half of the capacity of the line in gas, and other groups, because of a common carrier status, could use the rest. Since several Donlin officials were there in person, the DNR representatives closed the formal public hearing and opened up the floor for a question and answer session. In answer to questions about the possibility of Donlin running a parallel diesel pipeline, Donlin Gold's external affairs manager Kurt Parkins said,
one of the alternatives that's being looked at is a parallel diesel pipeline. And so that's going to be fully vetted by the cooperating agencies, which include several tribes in the region who are participants in that process.
Comments will be taken back to the state's pipeline coordinator's office for review and be taken into account as the office drafts the commissioner's analysis and a draft lease. Comments are being taken on the right-of-way until January 28, 2015. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A hearing takes place in Anchorage at the Lusac Library tonight. Hearings are also scheduled for Tyonek and Squintna. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Annie Ropeek and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, and Daisha Eaton and Ben Matheson in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. Didn't quite catch that report. Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.